Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And today's episode, it's just Todd and me. If you listened to our recent one with Jerry Bullard, you probably heard that there were a lot of things that went on in the legislature that are going to kind of impact some of our appellate and trial court practices going forward. So Todd and I thought we'd take a few minutes and maybe just kind of run down some of those legislative changes that have now been implemented by the Texas Supreme Court and Court of Criminal Appeals in the form of proposed or already passed rules. So we kind of wanted to hit a couple of highlights, and we may have a few more of these episodes going forward as the rules continue to develop and get put out while the court kind of takes on what the legislature has assigned them to do moving forward. So that's the purpose of this episode.
The Supreme Court Advisory Committee enabling, working with the Supreme Court to enable the recent legislative changes has given us a lot to talk about. And we could do this with guests if we wanted to, but we haven't had an opportunity recently for the two of us just to nerd out on something. And so I think this is a good chance to do that. And we will continue to monitor what the Supreme Court is doing in terms of releasing preliminarily approved rules. And I think it would make sense if we talked about some of those things and the ways that they will affect practitioners, trial lawyers and appellate lawyers alike going forward. So Jody, the one that we really thought we might focus on today, I think we'll have time to talk about some more, but there were some recent changes to the supersedious rules in the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, TRAP 24.1 and 24.2. But before we launch into the changes, which we think are good changes, by the way, we thought it might be beneficial just to have a relatively succinct conversation about what supersedious is and some of the background that will help, I think, set up this topic for discussion, because we really haven't talked a lot. We haven't focused very many episodes on supersedious. We had Dan Huckabee from Court Surety Bond Agency come on the show back in, I think it was October of 2020. We'll put a link to that episode in the show notes, but that episode really focused on how to get a bond, which was something that a lot of lawyers didn't know how to do. And it's still very useful information. So I'll refer listeners back to Dan's episode, but that's only part of what supersedious really involves. So this is kind of a very quick overview. There's a couple of different ways of looking at supersedious generally. We're talking about something that happens after the signing of either a final judgment or an order that can be taken up on interlocutory appeal. But the idea is, in part, is to protect the judgment creditor by providing some kind of security for either the amount that's been ordered, the judgment debtor has been ordered to pay in a judgment, or basically to maintain the status quo during, say, an appeal from a temporary injunction or something like that. And so if you've got a judgment, if you're the judgment creditor, you want some assurance that you're going to get paid. And that's really, from the judgment creditor's perspective, what supersedious is all about, is to try and maximize your ability to secure the judgment so that your collection efforts later are minimized. But then from the debtor's perspective, you don't want any more interference with, say, your business operations than you have to have, having suffered an adverse result on appeal, maybe looking at a big dollar judgment, lots of damages and so forth to pay. And so from the judgment debtor's perspective, what you want to do is you want to prevent the judgment creditor from using the methods that are provided for in the rules of civil procedure regarding execution of a post-judgment discovery, other kinds of collections processes that can really be a hassle from judgment debtor's perspective. So those are the two different viewpoints that courts have to consider when looking at these issues. And so just real quickly to overview what's potentially involved enforcing a judgment from the judgment creditor perspective, one thing that people worry about is, oh gosh, I have to supersede this right away. because otherwise I'm going to start losing property. And that's really not true, because we have built into our rules that you can't get a writ of execution until 30 days after the judgment is signed or a motion for new trial is decided. So while it is an important issue from the judgment debtor's perspective, and you need to be planning, it's very unlikely that there's going to be anything that's going to happen, you know, immediately after the judgment is signed. But one thing that can happen immediately after, of course, is the filing of an abstract of the judgment in the deed records of in the county wherever the judgment debtor owns property. That doesn't do anything immediately either, but it does create a judgment lien. So that's one reason to supersede a judgment, is to do an abstract or prevent there from being a judgment lien attached to property. But there's also things that, you know, we don't always think about, like getting a turnover order under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. That's a really powerful remedy for a judgment creditor to go and get non-exempt property. There's things that we don't deal with all that often in our own practices, like garnishing property or garnishing wages or things like that. But there are a few methods that can make it really inconvenient for a judgment debtor, like post-judgment discovery, for example. You will often see discovery that's authorized under Rule Civil Procedure 621A. You can basically do anything you can do leading up to the judgment, discovery-wise, post-judgment, to get at whatever the judgment debtor's assets are. And so there can be a lot of written discovery. There can be post-judgment depositions. And it's, you feel for clients in that situation, because it's really the signing of the judgment really isn't the end. To some degree, it's really just the beginning. And then there's some other provisions like Rule 628 that allows early execution if there's an affidavit stating that the judgment debtor is about to transfer or hide property. In my experience, that's not used all that often, but that's another method that can be used to try and get at the judgment debtor's assets. And so that takes us to sort of the basics of how to avoid those things, right? The rules for superseding judgments. Filing a notice of appeal, unless you're a government agency or government entity, is not going to be enough to supersede the judgment. So we'd have to direct our listeners to TRAP 24.1, which kind of lays out the basic methods of superseding a judgment. And those are filing a written agreement to supersede the judgment, a quote, good and sufficient bond, which is what is the focus of Dan Huckabee's episode with us, cash deposit in lieu of bond, or alternate security ordered by the court. I've litigated some of these alternate security issues and other issues over the course of my career. And you can spend a lot of money from the client's perspective, really, on either side of this. And so just looking at those basic ways, though, that's not our focus today. Let's talk about real quickly, though, what has to be superseded. And a lot of us who have done this kind of work can almost recite this rule from memory, right? What you have to post security on is an amount equaling the sum of compensatory damages awarded in the judgment. It's one element. The second is interest for the estimated duration of the appeal, which is another, and costs. And it used to be a lot more than that. You used to have to supersede basically the entire amount of the judgment. But 20 years ago now, which is hard to believe, the legislature removed that to where you only have to supersede those things: compensatory damages, not punitive damages, not treble damages under the DTPA, those sorts of things. And so this is one example, and we're going to talk about another one here in a minute. The legislature making decisions that make it really easier for judgment debtors to appeal and not have put more of their property at risk or put up as collateral than absolutely has to be. So another feature of that 2003 change was to put caps on the amount of security that had to be brought. And so for money judgments, the amount must not exceed the lesser of 50% of the judgment debtor's net worth or $25 million. This is another very ripe area for litigation, because I think you've seen this, Jody, certainly have. There's a big disagreement about what someone's net worth is.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, that can be its own huge fight with its own separate discovery and evidentiary hearings and all that, because if challenged, essentially the trial court has to set a net worth. And so both sides are going to have to put on evidence to get there.
Right. And it took a while for this to kind of shake out, but I think it's pretty clear now that if you file what we call a negative net worth affidavit, you can show that your net worth is less than zero, then that is de facto supersedious. There's a provision in the rules that say that if you're the judgment creditor and you don't like the net worth, then you can certainly challenge that. And that's the process that you're alluding to. In my experience, these are almost like temporary injunction hearings. There's a full presentation of evidence. The trial court has to make findings. It has to actually pick a number of what the judgment debtor's net worth is.
Yeah, no, that's exactly my experience.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. And so I have advised clients to hire a forensic accountant because you're in for a fight. And so this was a good rule because companies were at risk of bankruptcy. You know, if they couldn't supersede the judgment, then all the devices that we talked about earlier could have been employed to go and get their assets. And so between the legislature and to some degree, the Texas Supreme Court, over the trend over the last 20 years has certainly been to make it easier for judgment debtors to appeal and to supersede judgments. But it is important to remember that just because there's a bond set, just because there's a net worth affidavit, whether it's negative or not, to establish the supersedious amount, doesn't mean that that's fixed in stone. There's a review process built into the rules. You can file a motion to review the security amount in the Court of Appeals, and then there can be a whole nother round of essentially appellate briefing addressing this narrow issue of security on appeal.
Yeah, it's a lot like its own little mandamus proceeding, while ostensibly the whole appeal is going forward too.
That's right. And so we could spend a whole episode, I'm sure, talking about all this stuff, and because it's super interesting. And it, as we suggested, it's something that true appellate nerds really like to
absolutely.
It's worth mentioning though, too, just briefly before we launch into the changes, that, you know, we have this whole idea of non-monetary final judgments, like a temporary injunction. And is where it gets really tricky because you can do math and figure out, all right, I've got an expert and I've got an affidavit that says my client's net worth is X. You don't have a money judgment. The rules say that the trial court must fix the amount of security that the judgment, quote unquote, debtor must post. And so that's where you get into a really soft area where the trial court, I think, has a lot of discretion. And so this really hits when you are dealing with, again, temporary injunctions are the best example, because the whole idea, first of all, the idea of a TI is to preserve the status quo.
Right.
If you get that, then circumstances under which that TI can be superseded on appeal so that whatever was happening before the TI can return to the state of being, as it were. Mm-hmm. These are really difficult issues to litigate.
They are.
So I guess where we can wind this segment of this episode up, Jody, is with something that we say fairly often, which is, don't try this at home. If you're dealing with these issues as a litigator, as a trial lawyer, at least call your friendly neighborhood appellate lawyer who's got some experience with this. You can read the rules, but excuse me, there's really no substitute for talking to someone who's actually litigated these issues before.
That's right. Unique and special and a little bit strange.
They're all of those things. And like so many things that we as lawyers generally do today, very research and writing intensive, and the documentary evidence really needs to be shored up, or else you run the risk of, well, it's all fine and good, depending on which side of the issue you're on.
Right.
It's all fine and good to have gone and gotten this temporary injunction, but if you lose it because the other side is able to supersede it, you just need to be prepared that just getting a TI isn't the end of the road. You've got to
That's right.
Be prepared to deal with the supersedious issues on appeal. So that's probably as much depth as we need to go into for background and to just kind of remind ourselves and our listeners of all the different things that are in play. And frankly, why the rule change to trap 24.1 and 24.2 that you're about to discuss is so important.
I think that that's right. And I can't remember how many years ago now, it's probably been closer to 10 years ago. The Texas Supreme Court had a case called In Re Longview Energy that was kind of a seminal mandamus on supersedious issues. And one of the things that the court went at length to talk about was that Texas currently is and kind of has historically been a debtor-friendly state. And that certainly is reflected in our supersedious rules. And Todd kind of mentioned the courts have to strike the balance. I think in our state, certainly in more recent years, the legislature and courts have struck that balance in favor of the judgment debtor. You know, in federal court, you're pretty much going to supersede the whole judgment. But here, as Todd said, it really is compensatory damages, which is truly damages. It's not attorney's fees. It's not punitive damages. So you see some eye-popping judgments that could be tens of millions of dollars, but when you get down to what the actual supersedious piece is for your client, it can be a much smaller number, which is not necessarily insignificant, but I think some of the changes to the rules sort of reflect that policy balance that courts and the legislature have struck. And I know saying policy balance in the term of courts would probably make some of our current Supreme Court justices blanch, but you know, it is. Because these rules certainly reflect legislative policies put into action. So like Todd talked about, there's several ways you can do it. And the one that was sort of always the most nebulous and unknown in the Rule 24.1 context was alternate security. What did it mean? And I'll tell you, I've had it come up in several cases, and it's just not clear. Courts had discretion to allow or not allow, but I think the idea behind it was, say that you have a client that, for instance, owns a bunch of real estate, and maybe that real estate gives them a pretty significant net worth, but it's not liquid. It's not something that they can just cash in and may create problems for them to do a bond because they can't necessarily generate revenue that's going to pay the bond premiums. Well, I think if you had that land as collateral, potentially the idea would be, well, you pledge that as alternate security because it could be a very significant part of a judgment debtor's net worth. If it's unencumbered, it's not going anywhere. And they're secured to the same extent as would be maybe a bond company that's going to use that same land as collateral, but then also charge a premium on top of it. So I think that things like securities, stocks, bonds, things that can be pledged that have intrinsic value that don't necessarily have to be liquidated at a loss. So that was the idea. The cases I've had it come up in, it's never really worked because on the one side, you have the judgment debtor saying, well, I have these assets I want to pledge. And usually you have the judgment creditor saying, well, I think I'd prefer a bond because then I know I'm going to get cash and I'm not going to have to be the person that's then charged with either taking possession of this land or liquidating this land, trying to sell it. You know, I'd much rather just have the bond, which I completely understand from a practical perspective. So it really was just up to a trial court as to what you do with this. And that's why I never really saw it allowed, because if they didn't allow it, it's an abuse of discretion standard. And I never saw a court of appeals actually overturn that on the alternate security front. So in these rule changes, the legislature and then by extension, the rules that the court wrote have actually given us some guideposts for alternate security. And what's not clear to me, because the way that the rule reads now is, you can provide alternate security under Rule 24.2E, which is the provision I'm going to talk about, or ordered by the court, which I think leaves open the possibility that what I'm about to tell you is not the only way that you can post alternate security, but I think it's going to be probably the most common way going forward. So there's still some room out there, some wiggle room for ways to get alternate security outside of this context, but I think 24.2E, which as I'm going to discuss, is going to be the way going forward that you're going to see alternate security used. And what it says, it's going to apply to a judgment debtor with a net worth of less than $10 million. So I think the idea of this is to not necessarily benefit people with high net worth, a lot of assets, large companies, things like that. But these really are the people, and I use people collectively, talking about entities and people who are going to be the most impacted by a significant judgment. You know, someone that may have a high net worth, what a lot of us would think of as a high net worth, but less than $10 million still may have a real crunch trying to figure out a way to put up either half of their net worth or the judgment amount and getting a bond and being able to pay bond premium. So this gives them a way if they have assets that could be used to satisfy their supersedious obligations. So to do that, if they have less than $10 million net worth, which of course, as Todd talked about, can be its own fight. If you can cross that threshold and you have evidence to support that, then the judgment debtor has to make a showing that posting security in the amount under whatever it is, whether it's half the net worth, the judgment amount, compensatory damages, would require the judgment debtor to substantially liquidate the judgment debtor's interest in real or personal property necessary to the normal course of the judgment debtor's business, which I think basically means kind of what I talked about. If you have, for instance, a lot of your net worth tied up in land that you can't necessarily just give over or liquidate or turn into cash, this gives you a way to say, look, I have a high net worth. It probably, if we posted half of that, would secure the judgment. But to do so, I'm going to have to sell off all my land holdings to come up with the cash to be able to post a bond and to continue to pay the bond premiums going forward. So if you can make that showing, the trial court has no discretion and has to allow the judgment debtor to post that alternate security with a value sufficient to secure the judgment. So this does give an avenue to go outside of the traditional bond route and to avoid the bond premiums, which, by the way, are not recoverable in Texas state court. They may be in federal court, but you know, if you look at bond premiums run, or if you have to get a letter of credit, you're talking somewhere between 1% and 4% of the amount of the bond every single year. So you start doing the math on that, adds up very, very quickly over the 2 or 3 years it can take.
That's kind of a aside on that point. I just wonder why our legislature hasn't conformed Texas law to federal law on that. I mean, it's now granted, that's a big hammer. I've been in federal court when there's been a loss and suddenly you're looking at a really large bill as part of the bill of costs for that bond premium. And it can be devastating. So I think what it means is it maybe even encourages more resolutions of significant cases on appeal in federal court. But as you point out, we just don't have that in state court. So what we have in terms of appellate costs are usually pretty nominal for the most part. So I'm curious as to, and I don't remember, maybe we should have asked Jerry this when we had him on last time, but what has been the movement toward bringing Texas law into alignment with federal law? And I just don't know the answer off the top of my head. I did also notice as you were talking there about that subpart two, Jody, that there's no discretion. The word must is used, which is the new shall, right? So
literally, that is a change they keep making in the rules in Texas as they cross out shall and put in must instead.
I personally don't think there was ambiguity in shall, but hey, that's another debate. But as you point out, though, we've got the first level fight here is your net worth less than $10 million? So you can count on a fight happening with that.
And by the way, in Texas, you cannot use the judgment amount to reduce your net worth. Right. So you know, if you have a net worth of $10 million and a $10 million judgment, your net worth is not zero. Your net worth is still $10 million for judgment supersedious purposes.
People keep trying, though.
Oh, and I know they do. And maybe one day the Supreme Court will say it's okay. But so far, the courts of appeals have rejected that pretty uniformly, I think.
I think it all comes down to generally accepted accounting principles.
And that's right.
I think an accountant, any forensic accountant that you get to testify, looking at what are truly gaps, generally accepted accounting principles are going to say that this contingent liability is not in debt factor.
It makes sense. I mean, it's hard to say it's anything but contingent when you are also appealing it and trying to challenge it. No, at the same time, it does seem to be a little bit inconsistent, kind of take both positions. But you leave that to the experts who can say what gap requires.
I do like the fact that there's no discretion, though, because I've been in a situation where I was trying to... It was exactly the scenario you described. It was a client who had land or other assets, not securities, but interest in a limited partnership. And we were having a really hard time figuring out how to convert that interest in a limited partnership into alternate security. That's the best argument we could make was he could pledge it as an asset. And of course, then you have the issues of, well, are you able to pledge that asset? You know, what other... You've pointed out other encumbrances are on it. What does the partnership agreement say? There's a lot of limitations on that. But if you're dealing with just a straight up situation where your client's got land, got real estate, it's got value. Yes, of course. Execution and getting paid is going to be a lot easier if you're just talking about a bond for the reasons you said. Not to mention the fact that one thing that appellees need to remember to do is to request that the judgment be rendered against the surety, which the rules provide for.
Yep, so on appeal.
Yeah. That's something that gets overlooked a lot. And if you've got a bond situation where there actually is a supersedious bond in place as an appellee, don't forget to do that. But I really like how this is shaping up to make it better for judgment debtors. Yeah, $10 million is a lot of money, but this is not Microsoft or Amazon or something like that. So I think this is, we haven't even gotten all the way through it yet. And I'm sorry if I derailed your conversation.
No. This is the reason we're doing this. But I think you're right. And, you know, $10 million is a lot of money. But if you look at, for example, if you live in Austin, Texas and have owned your house for about 15 years, you may be surprised at what your net worth might look like on paper. So it adds up quickly for people who maybe have a small business or are a little bit older and have some interest in oil and gas properties. The numbers come up quicker than you think they do. So I think this applies to a lot of people. So that's kind of the prong that you have to show. And then another thing that's in the rule, which is sub three, is that during the appeal, if you've pledged your alternate security, the judgment debtor gets to keep continuing to manage, use, and receive earnings from whatever it is you've pledged in the normal course of business, which was another place that was a little bit unclear before. Okay, well, you post this land. Well, what happens if you get rents and revenues? Does that go to the judgment debtor? Does that go to the creditor? And this just makes it clear that it's the person who has pledged the land that gets to keep to continue to use that.
That's good clarification. When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. When I first read this subpart, I thought it really meant something else because I've had a situation where you're not supposed to be hindered against transferring assets in the ordinary course of business. But I'd had a client who was accused of fraudulent transfer, and he ran a real estate speculation organization, and that was their business, is transferring real estate. So, but this doesn't quite go to that. You've made clear for me that what this really gets at is if there's any income generated off the property that's pledged, yeah, that stays with the judgment debtor.
Yeah. For example, the person that I kind of see as one of the ones that this is intended to benefit is, say, somebody in West Texas that owns a lot of land and maybe has a ranch or something. You're using that land to raise cattle, sell cattle off of that. You can keep the money from that. You may have some oil and gas interests on that property that are paying you royalty interest or whatever it is. You can continue to use and reinvest those revenues, which in the long run probably benefits the judgment creditor to some extent, because it's going to make sure that you keep your net worth and it's not having to go to pay bond premiums and you're using up your available cash and you just end up whatever you have left at the end of it.
Your hand, Jody, though, this is, again, I think this is a good rule, but you think about gambling with your real estate.
Yeah.
That's really what this is. You're in a position as a judgment debtor where money judgment's enforceable pending appeal unless you supersede, as we've talked about. So you either have to follow the general rules of supersedious, which is to put up a bond, which involves a premium, as you said, put up a cash deposit, which involves allocating whatever, I'm sure, a significant amount of your available cash and putting in an interest-bearing account in the court's registry or, you know, in a CD or something like that. You can reach an agreement with your opposing counsel on that. But you're now to the point, bottom line is it's never a good thing to be the judgment debtor.
No, absolutely not. I'm not suggesting that.
And I know you're not. This is a good solution, as we said. What we need to remember here, I've touched on it a little bit, is just because this rule is here doesn't mean the opportunities for advocacy have gone away.
No, definitely not. And in fact, I think if anything, they're now going to be even a little bit greater because you have first the net worth question, and then you now have to put on the showing that it's going to require you to substantially liquidate your interest in real or personal property necessary to the normal course of your business. I mean, that's several elements that are going to have to be proven with testimony, with evidence, probably with some expert testimony as well about rents, revenues, costs, available cash. You'll probably have to have an accounting expert, maybe even a bank expert or a supersedious person to talk about what the cost for letters of credit and bond premiums and all that run.
100% correct. So new legislation, so often we see it as sort of full employment act for appellate lawyers, at least in the short term. But this is one where I do think this benefit is going to come with some cost. And the cost is going to be the judgment creditor is more than likely going to fight you on net worth, starting with that. And then, as I touched on earlier, and then we can move on. I do think, you know, if you're talking about something in the neighborhood of 10 million or even considerably less than that, as a trial lawyer who is trying to litigate this issue, I would recommend that people do not rely on their client to establish net worth here.
Right.
You should have books and records, profit and loss statements, balance sheets, things that an accounting expert can look at and give you credible testimony of what the client's net worth is. Because it seems simple, assets, less liabilities. But as we've talked about, you still got folks trying to slip in, you know, the amount of the judgment as being liabilities. Again, the standard is generally accepted accounting principles. And who's qualified to testify about that?
Not me.
Not me.
Well, and it also to your point, Todd, if, for instance, one of their significant assets is an interest in a limited partnership, I mean, how do you value that? And the answer is there's a lot of different ways you can do that. And you probably need someone with the expertise be able to come in and explain under generally accepted accounting principles how you get there.
That's right. 100% agree.
All right. So that's kind of the alternate security piece, which I think we'll probably see used more just because it was so hard to get it in the past. I don't know how much, but the one that really, when you're talking about the appellate lawyer full employment part of this, is subsection. And this is a huge change for anyone that has done bonds in Texas for very long, because the rule in Texas forever has been, if you appeal a judgment and you win in the intermediate court of appeals, that does not change your supersedious. So for example, you have a $10 million judgment from the trial court, you get that substantially reduced, or you even get it rendered to a take nothing judgment in the intermediate court of appeals, your client still has to maintain whatever sort of supersedious they had in place on that $10 million judgment all the way until the Texas Supreme Court review process is complete, which has always seemed a little weird if you think about it, because you've appealed. But the logic behind it, and I get it, is, well, the Court of Appeals judgment isn't final until the Texas Supreme Court has had its say, or it hasn't gone to that step and the mandate has finally issued, all the rehearings are done. But there's a real practical effect in there. Your client can be spending tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the meantime on bond premiums or whatever it is. So subsection F, I think, finally fixes that. So if you have an appeal and the appellate court reduces the amount of judgment that the trial court used to set the bond or deposit or whatever, at that point, the judgment debtor can go back while the appeal is still pending, whether it's at the Court of Appeals rehearing stage, at the Texas Supreme Court stage, and ask the trial court, which, by the way, all the supersedious enforcement determination, it all takes place in the trial court. The Court of Appeals wants no part of it, unless they're doing a review of what the trial court has done.
Right.
And the trial court gets to redetermine what the correct amount of the bond deposit or security could be, which can be a huge change going forward for people that may help out judgment creditors. It's probably, or judgment debtors. It's not one that judgment creditors, I think, are going to like necessarily, because it does reduce some leverage that they have. But it's probably strikes a pretty common sense balance that, well, if you've won in an appellate court, then you probably deserve to have that redetermined at the trial court stage.
It does make a lot of sense. I mean, sure, what happened in the trial court was technically a final judgment. If your final judgment is reversed or modified, it's really not final anymore. And so I think it's a sensible change. Again, do we really want, just thinking back to your basic property law, do we really want money tied up doing nothing for years, potentially, while an appeal gets decided? Do we want it? How much do we want to bank on whether there's going to be a Texas Supreme Court review when statistically the odds are very low that that's going to happen? So again, I totally agree. This is another example of something that did need to be changed. And I'm happy that the legislature did it and also provided appellate lawyers some more work.
Mm-hmm. And I'll throw this out there. I've represented clients on both sides of these issues as judgment creditors and judgment debtors. And one thing I think for both sides to think about is when you're coming up with supersedious, there's the methods that a judgment debtor can use to force supersedious, essentially, and they get to do that. But think about the practicalities. You know, Todd and I mentioned the bond premiums, for example. If you have a client that has a decent net worth and can find a way to supersede the judgment, but it's going to require them to use up all of their available cash and start eating into assets to pay bond premiums. You know, think about as the judgment creditor, if that makes sense for you, because at the end of the day, if what you're essentially left with is mostly exempt property, does it really make sense to require them to do that when you might be able to get some kind of cash or some sort of resolution? Because you can come up with an agreement to supersede the judgment, which could be them paying over some cash to you for you to waive the requirement of a strict supersedeas bond. I don't know, but just be creative and be practical when you're looking at this from the outset, or even later on in the appeal, if it turns out that it's creating issues, because these things can cost a significant amount of time and money to litigate the supersedeas stuff. I mean, some of it, like Todd and I mentioned earlier, the motion to review process can be just like a mandamus and can take a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of effort from both the parties and the trial and appellate courts. So consider if that practically makes sense, even if it's legally permissible.
Yeah. The first thing I advise trial lawyers who reach out to me on these issues to do is, or at least I ask the question, is there any possibility that this can be handled by agreement? And a lot of times, by the time you've been through a trial, you know, the parties really don't want to cooperate with each other.
Absolutely.
I think that's pretty short-sighted. It could be the time, I suppose, to puff up, say, oh, we're going to go collect everything now. And depending on how the parties have conducted themselves in litigation, that probably is a pretty good predictor of what the response would be. I've seen it where the parties just couldn't stand each other and there was never going to be any agreement.
Yep. There's a ton of leverage in being a judgment creditor, because even if it gets superseded, that doesn't necessarily stop the post-judgment discovery. The trial court still has discretion to allow that. So it does create some leverage if you're trying to get a case settled or resolved.
I think once there's a supersedeas of whatever kind that's sufficient under Trap 24, I think that should moot the discovery if there is any out there. But it does stop every other method. So it is sort of, this is a kind of a black or white issue. You've either superseded or you haven't under the law. But it's like everything else in litigation. If you can figure out a way to not fight about it any more than you have to, It goes against our nature sometimes because we're trained to fight, right? But you got to think ultimately about what's in the client's best interest. But I will say that being sitting on the judgment creditor side of this, yes, the legislature's made it easier and better for judgment debtors, but you still have some powerful weapons at your disposal.
Absolutely.
As a judgment creditor, particularly turnover, receiverships. And so we haven't even talked about fraudulent transfer lawsuits, something else to be mindful of. That's beyond the scope of our discussion today, but there's so much, as you said, Jody, there's so much satellite litigation that spins off of this, and which is exactly what the Texas Supreme Court is trying to avoid. And not just the Supreme Court. Obviously, these changes come from the legislature, but I think the legislature and the Supreme Court are of one mind on this issue. You don't want to spend money litigating about this kind of stuff. You really want to spend your money litigating about the merits.
That's right.
So, but bottom line, if you're whichever side of the situation you're on, you know, strongly consider whether there's any ground for agreement. And I would suggest don't disagree just to disagree. But at the same time, it's a case by case decision. So,
well, it is. You know, you have to be assured that what you're getting from the judgment debtor, and if you're the judgment creditor, is correct, honest, truthful, and legitimately represents what they can or can't do. That's part of your duty to your client to make sure that you know it, you understand it, and you believe it. So, I mean, there's a lot of caveats here, but just you're right. And I think just as a general principle, it can take a lot of time and resources that could better be used elsewhere to have some of these fights when maybe you don't have to.
Well, before we move on from this rule change, well, I do want to say we ought to point out this is the order from miscellaneous docket number 23-9062 released. Was it last week before last? And this rule change, all the supersedious issues, the rule is out in the comment period right now, but the rule change will take effect. It's anticipated to take effect on January 1 of 2024. So The Supreme Court, it's more traditional path of releasing proposed rules, allowing time for public comment, and then the effective date of the rules being a little bit later than some of the ones that have been released lately. Mm-hmm. But before we move on from this set of rules completely, we talked about this a little bit during our last episode with Jerry Bullard, but it is important to note that this TRAP 24.1, and we'll drop a redline copy of this in the show notes, 24.1B2 has been changed to make a supersedious bond effective upon filing and not when approved by the trial clerk. We covered that some last time. That is a noteworthy change.
It is.
Makes it easier and simpler procedurally to get a bond in place without having to wait on a clerk to apply their signature when it really makes no difference at all. It's being done.
And a party can still challenge it. If you think whatever was filed doesn't meet the statutory requirements or isn't a proper bond, you can still file a motion to get the court to review it and see if it's true. But it does make it a whole lot quicker that once you file it, it's effective.
I've seen parties want to challenge a bond because the surety wasn't sufficient. They didn't have an AM Best rating, 4 stars or whatever it is. It's good to not have that lay in the hands of a clerk. If someone wants to challenge the sufficiency of the bond or getting, you don't have to be a $1 billion bond company to sign a supersedious bond. You can be an individual. And so it is important to have, yes, what this does to me, Jody, is it puts a bond in the same position as a negative net worth affidavit.
Right.
It's effective immediately. And then you've got the fail-safe provisions in the rules that allow challenges. If there are problems, you're free to raise those as the judgment creditor. And
that's right.
The trial court to do something about it. And if you don't like what the trial court did, there's a process for getting the Court of Appeals to review it.
That's right.
So I think that's all we have to say for today on supersedious. You want to talk about some of these other rule changes that have been announced? We have final rules now in miscellaneous docket number 23-9071 involving rules of civil procedure 21, 165A, 239A, and a few others, including the rules on findings of fact, conclusions of law, rule 306A, and a few more. And these are notable. I think this is the case when the Supreme Court announced these rule changes, it made them effective immediately before comment period. But now what the court has done, it's taken into account public comment and gone ahead and issued an order declaring these changes to be final. We'll also drop these in the show notes so that everyone has the red lines if they want to get them. But I think some of these are worth talking about.
I think that that's right. And we don't have to go through every one. I mean, the gist of all of these changes is the new requirement that the trial court has to send through some sort of electronic filing service provider the actual orders or notices or judgments that it signs, which has really not been standardized across Texas's 254 counties before now. So it very well could be you file something in a case somewhere and you don't get a ruling. You don't get a ruling. Turns out the court signed and ruled on it. It went into the court's file. Your time for appeal or some other deadline was running from the time of that order, and you just don't find out about it until after that period passes. And that has been a problem for years and years. As long as I've been practicing law, that's been a problem. Varies wildly. I mean, it varies wildly by county. It varied wildly by judges. And there just was no standardization. And I think that this is the attempt to finally get that to happen by requiring the court to send out these orders through the electronic service provider when they actually sign them and enter them.
Yeah, what we've been hearing a little bit, we've got some on the ground intel. This rule was supposed to go into effect and be implemented September 1. So for the last basically, 3 weeks as of the date of this recording, probably a month or a little longer by the time this comes out. But we are getting reports, we're just going to still call it Twitter. We're not going to call it X, that some larger counties were going to have a difficult time implementing this on time. So one cautionary tale I would say is this is great. I love it. This is something that the Judicial Committee on Information Technology has been trying to get adopted for quite some time, either through a rule change or through something on the electronic service provider end of things. And this does, I think, mostly what JCIT was wanting. But I don't think if you are a lawyer with cases in one of those places that has been historically not provided copies of orders, I would wait a little while longer before I rely exclusively on this rule. it's going to make things so much better in terms of maintaining your case files.
Absolutely.
Keeping your staff from having to make 10 phone calls trying to find out if an order has been signed in a rural county. And let's just face it, it's typically a rural county where this happens, although not always.
Though not exclusively.
Not exclusively. No, not at all. And that was especially tricky in the rural counties that didn't have great online docket systems. Literally, it was a phone call. You had to call the clerk. And so I have to think that at the end of the day, this is a good rule for clerks too, because they control the whole process of releasing an order into the e-filing system. And it does put the burden notably on the clerk, not on the trial court. So that's who we're talking about being really affected here. But there has to be an offset between the reduction in phone calls to the clerk's offices.
That's true.
The additional effort in uploading and, you know, whatever you have to do to get an order into the e-filing system. I would think you could design a process for that as a clerk that wouldn't chew up hours out of your day. I wouldn't think. Trial courts sign a lot of orders. There's no question there. I think we need to be mindful of that. This does add something of a burden to the clerks. Mm-hmm. And JCIT is going to be looking at that. Part of this very order, paragraph 5, charges JCIT with studying and making recommendations on copying court orders, notices, and other documents in civil cases to research Texas. Well, that's really what this is designed to do. Is that was the problem. You know, Research Texas being the created and designed as sort of a PACER-like system for Texas state court cases where you could go and look at documents and download them even as a non-party. The big glaring hole in that system was because courts were not e-filing their orders, orders were not getting into Research Texas. And so you couldn't rely on it that way. And it's frustrating even today to get involved in a new case, trying to figure out what's going on. Your trial lawyer's busy, doesn't have staff, can't just share their file with you for whatever reason, or their file's not maintained, you know, the way you would want it to be. You can go and get all the pleadings off of Research Texas, but you could not go and get all the orders. And so in orders, as we know, and what we do, are they're everything. A judgment is something that's going to be challenged, a ruling on summary judgment. I mean, the nuts and bolts of the case are, yes, the pleadings, but what the trial court does and how it exemplifies its decisions through orders is everything. So we can't quite yet, I would say, count on all clerk's offices being in compliance with this rule. But I know JCIT is meeting soon. First meeting that we've had since these rules were announced, since the legislative session, actually. And so I know we're going to be talking about how we can make it easier for clerks to comply with this and how we get the message to clerks that you really need to do this. What we hear from them a lot in meetings, this is all public record, I'm not giving anything away, is, well, it's great for the legislature and the Supreme Court to tell us that we have to do something, but they're not giving us any money to do it with. It does cause a burden to them. It does create a burden for clerks. But once this is actually fully implemented, I think it's going to be great for so many reasons. It's going to make informing your clients easier because you're going to be able to forward stuff that wouldn't come in your inbox before. You're going to be able to download it straight to your system instead of having to go in and get it and scanning it. It's just, I think, I don't want to say it's a sea change. That's a big phrase, but it is an extremely important accomplishment. I think it will help make Research Texas what it was supposed to be.
I think that's good. And that really is kind of the big takeaway here, is that this process, once implemented, is going to give you electronic notice of orders and judgments and findings of fact, things that necessarily impact your deadlines, particularly on appeals. So just keep an eye out for that. But until it's fully up and running, keep doing your due diligence and don't just rely on the fact that this rule exists going forward.
That's right. And so moving on through the rule changes in the same order, as you suggested, Jody, what you see is a lot of changes made to conform existing rules to the notice requirement. For example, the dismissal for want of prosecution rule 165A specifically requires notice to be given as provided in what is now rule 21F10, the rule requiring clerks to send notice through the e-filing system. So, I mean, obviously that's a problem. If you don't get notice of a DWOT, can happen. And so now the clerks are required to give you notice of a DWOP using that same method. Same thing, Rule 239A for notice of default judgment. Again, you know, just a default judgment being just another form of final judgment. The deadlines start right away. The clock starts ticking on that day zero for getting a notice of appeal or a motion for new trial on file. And so this is going to help, I think, cut down on the Rule 306A4 motions that for extending the time to file post-judgment motions within certain parameters. What would happen is you would have a situation like we've described where someone didn't get notice of a judgment. Well, the rules allow for that and allow you to file a post-judgment motion if you can show that you didn't get notice within a certain range of time. The numbers for those should go way down. As long as the party is represented by counsel and is getting notice through the e-filing system, you know, I would think that would really cure a lot of those issues.
And one note on defaults for trial lawyers or appellate lawyers for that matter, under the new 239A, you need to certify to the clerk not only the last known mailing address, but the last known email address of the party. So update your affidavit forms to stick that in there. Yes.
That's great advice. So, you know, again, Rule 246, clerks to give notice of settings. You actually have to get notice through the e-filing system now. It incorporates Rule 21F10 of trial court settings, which is great. Same
thing. But you have to ask for it in writing.
Oh, yeah. So be sure and look at that. Same thing on the rules 297 through about 300, I think, or have to do with findings of fact, conclusions of law. There's some interesting change in terminology here about sending. The trial court must send its findings of fact, conclusions of law rather than file them. I'm not sure I really understand the purpose of that change. The timeline hasn't changed.
Yeah. I guess the notice now runs from the date it's sent as opposed to filed in the court's record. And, you know, there is that sort of weird, when was it entered versus when was it filed? When's it effective? So I don't know if under this new rule now it's when it's sent.
I'm sure there's a good reason for that that was thoroughly debated by SCAC.
Yeah, we'll have to have somebody on from there to tell us what they really meant.
And this is 297. There's a couple of shalls struck through, actually three that I see. In favor of must, which that I'm all for consistency. That's great. Similar changes made to Rule 298 about additional or amended findings, Rule 299 omitted findings, and Rule 299 about keeping findings of facts separate from the judgment. And then, yeah, here Rule 306 again incorporates 21F10. That's the requirement that the clerk give notice of a judgment. I think this is a good change. This actually requires sending the judgment order. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the old days, I think all the clerk had to do was send a postcard by mail. Mm-hmm. Postcard wouldn't say what the judgment was. It would just say
that there was a judgment.
And this is an important change in my
view. It is.
I like this much better. So what else we got in here?
I think that's it from this one. Then it's same thing for appellate courts, but that really, in my experience, been a problem. They're pretty good about sending all their orders already.
Yeah, that was already happening. We've gotten used to it now after well over 10 years of being mandatory e-filing jurisdiction. Of interest, I see, you know, the court starting to roll out electronic filing rules in criminal cases. I know we've got some folks that we're friendly with on Twitter who lament that the civil lawyers get all the bells and whistles. Doug Gladden, I'm talking to you. Hopefully this is going to be the beginning of something really good on the criminal side too. I know that is something that's on the JCIT's agenda. The criminal lawyers ought to have it as good as the civil lawyers for purposes of being able to file and rely on e-filing. So hopefully that will actually happen. So I think that takes us to the end, Jody, of where we thought we might go today. But as
I'll throw out one more that's just sort of we mentioned it with Jerry and it's on the horizon, and I file this under the not reducing satellite litigation piece. But the Supreme Court has amended, pursuant to what the legislature passed, Rule 28.3. So now in a permissive appeal scenario, a court of appeals has got to give specific reasons why it's denying a permissive appeal. I think stay tuned for what that's going to mean. Before, you got about a two-sentence paragraph that said it doesn't meet the standards. Now I'm wondering if we're going to get a three-sentence paragraph that says it doesn't meet the standards and here's a sentence why, or if we're going to get more, because that can then be reviewed at the Supreme Court de novo And if they decide that the Court of Appeals got it wrong, they can send it back to him and say, you get to take it. So,
yeah, I actually have written on this a little bit, and thanks for bringing that up. Yep. We talked about it a little bit with Jerry, and I gave some of my thoughts during that episode, but I'll post a link. I've got a Texas Law Book article that talks about this. I think it's a great change for lots of reasons, and some of which I've already talked about on the podcast. But again, going to Full Employment Act for appellate lawyers, you have a chance. If your argument is going to be that there's an issue that's substantially, the exact verbiage of the rule is escaping me at the moment.
Substantial disagreement.
Yeah.
Over the controlling question of laws.
It has to do with, is this going to be a potentially dispositive issue? Is the way I like to think about it. And if you've got potentially a dispositive issue, that the inherent meaning of that is that it could be something that guides the conclusion of the case. What better opportunity is there for getting an appellate lawyer involved in your case and helping you to tee that issue up in the trial court, also in the appellate courts? Because what we have to remember is you have to get not only the permission of the trial court to do this, but the permission of the Court of Appeals too. That's getting at what you're talking about, Jody, about the whether it's going to be two sentences or three sentences. The legislature has seen fit to give the Supreme Court de novo review over that decision. And so theoretically, what we're going to start seeing are petitions for review that focus, they should be limited.
I think so.
Only the issue of the Court of Appeals erred, because this is error, right? This is not,
right.
This is not
use of discretion. Typical,
this is an important issue, to the jurisprudence of the state. I think that's still there, but there's no discretion in this decision, and the Supreme Court is being charged with reviewing these de novo. So for an error of law, whether that standard was met or not. And so I think we're going to start seeing petitions for review. We're going to start seeing decisions out of the Court of Appeals that have to confront the standard that's been set, that if you're going to deny, you got to explain why. You got to explain why the rule, the provisions in the rule weren't met. And I would say it's going to have to be something more than two sentences or three sentences.
I think that's right. And then I think there's probably going to be some litigation over that question of how much do you need to say before it's not enough, whether it's, do you get sent back down because it's conclusory and the Supreme Court wants more? I don't know. There's a lot of things that are going to have to be figured out on this.
The de novo standard to me would imply that maybe more likely to see than the court saying it's not enough is to say, no, the standard was met, and then sending it back. But I think we're going to have to wait and see what the courts of appeals do here. Maybe we bookmark this and come back after we've seen a few of these and really dive in and see what's happening and how the Supreme Court is handling it, because it is something that's, procedurally different than anything we've seen. This whole idea of de novo review, it's kind of like a summary judgment, I guess, in that way. But, how is the Supreme Court going to handle it? I don't expect there to be a ton of cases, but I do think, as I said in the article, if you've got clients who are really concerned about their net spend on litigation, and you've got what you think in your evaluation is a really good issue that could, from the defense side, get rid of the whole case, boy, I would sure be looking at these very closely. Mm-hmm. It can go the other way. I mean, if I'm on the plaintiff's side, maybe I'm not so excited about this, but from the plaintiff's side, what you plaintiff's lawyers need to be mindful of is you're going to start seeing more of these, and you need to be prepared to respond to them.
And sometimes you may want the answer too. If it's truly an unsettled question and you'd rather know now than before you spend all the time and money going through trial, it may be better.
Yeah, 100%. All right, great. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there for today. We're going to keep our eyes open for more rules announcements, and I expect we'll probably have another episode or two along the same lines of what we've just recorded. So thanks everybody for sticking with us, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.